Everyone likes poetry in hell. When you run pale, then you get mail. Riding with Satan on a carousel. From the Don to the Dick to the Buxom Belle. Everyone likes poetry in hell. Everyone likes poetry in hell. When you get short and if you're not well. If you picked up something from an ugly scale. Even if the damn thing never sells. Everyone likes poetry in hell. Row!
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Alamus, the podcast about all things that matter to poetry, even as poetry doesn't matter. I'm William Frank, and with me tonight is my co-host, esteemed poet and boon companion, D.W. Stojak.
Hello there.
Thanks for joining us on our inaugural show. This ought to be a fumbly start. Apparently, we just found a microphone. Dan, what we got to show him today?
We're going to be talking about the passing of Jeffrey Hill and a wonderful poem by Kate Hudson. I think that will suffice. I think we're going to have some meat there.
Oh, God help us. Yes. Well, let's dig right in.
So, back on June 30th of this year, we lost Jeffrey Hill, one of our most esteemed poets.
We didn't really lose him. We know where he is.
That's quite right. We do. Or at least we pretend to. Well, he's somewhere in the Caribbean. But there's a bit of controversy regarding, I think, considering him to be one of England's best poets.
Yeah, that was pretty outrageous. They said, at least in that Guardian article, that he might be the best poet, English poet, in the last 70 years, and also maybe the greatest English poet of all time.
Which seems a little insane. You're knocking out people like Donne, Shakespeare. Jump in.
Yeah, I mean,
Auden.
Yeah, you know, and it's this kind of thing where we have this narrow view of time. You know, we tend to, you know, weigh more heavily on the present than in the past. But
well, I think it's also a situation where no one's familiar with the art anymore.
Mm.
To say that he's the greatest poet of all time, while absurd, he's the greatest poet, maybe perhaps. That they've had for a few years.
A few years at best. So I definitely agree. And, you know, it's all part of, you know, the idea of eulogy, too. You know, they argued with him about how inaccessible he was at times. But now, of course, you know, with the glow of death, he is, you know, now all of a sudden the greatest poet. So I think what we really want to try to do is find that kind of balance.
Rather than sentimentalize him and clothe him in this robe that he never actually truly wore.
Or deserved. Right. So, I mean, certainly a poem like Ovid and the Third Reich is really a meritorious poem and should be, you know, praised. But I think the body of the work, and you might disagree here, while it had flashes of brilliance, I don't think in the whole it really gives him the kind of regard that they're trying to bestow upon him.
Well, it seemed it was self-conscious, his work.
Hmm.
Very, very much. The more obscure it got, the more self-conscious he was.
Mm-hmm.
He was constantly saying, I'm not dealing on this plane. I'm dealing on a higher one. Something a little more difficult, a little more academic. I'm not pandering to you, which poetry should not do. It should not pander.
I agree. And a lot of that, you know, goes to kind of on a different track here when we talk about, you know, being elusive, being academic, which has always been rather pejorative. And so it kind of leads into questions sometimes about function of poetry. You know, should it be something that is founded on the imagination? Should it have something to do with elusive heritage, or should it be something more political?
Well, I think that always depends upon the person, but and I'd like to bring back a point that you had made before, prior to the conversation starting, was that he felt that his work was for a select group, and which is to most people something just a horrendous thing to say, that he's being elitist, that he's fine and he's comforted with working with this certain group and he's trusting them.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Do artists at this point, do poets at this point, have the resolve to trust their readers?
Yeah, I wonder that too. And especially nowadays too, where when you talk about the question of accessibility, information is so readily at hand. You know, we have search engines we're carrying around with us. And for that, we really have a privileged luxury to access any historical or cultural reference.
And poetry is wide open to explore any image, even the most shrouded, with less a fear of being too dense. Although some might argue that you can have too much frosting and not enough cake, though I would not.
One of the best things that I know definitely when first being brought into the internet back in the early aughts was that I found online a copy of The Wasteland that was hypertext, where you just click and brought you to a whole reference page on to whatever allusion, whatever reference that was, you know, allocated to. And it was a brilliant piece. It was as if this is what was custom made for.
Right.
It was just like, here's how this should work.
Right.
And it was a beautiful benefit. Does that mean, did we lose something by jumping in there and just jumping to the notes first? Elliot's the one who caused this issue. I think there was something wonderful about the notes that came with The Wasteland, and yet there was something deleterious.
Yeah, something a little arbitrary about it. One respect, too, the Wasteland notes really served to prop up, you know, what was a thin proposition for a book. But by the other token, you know, it really, I thought, did a great job of being, if not complete, at least a bridge to really a new collage form.
Fair enough. But let me ask you. But this device, this situation that we're dealing with now, as far as appending notes and what have you, basically came out of commerce. A small book that needed to be padded out so it could be sold to market. That's a difficult, you know, he's literally fattening the poem for market.
Yeah.
And critical slaughter.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, it's so funny, too, because if you look at any of the project, you know, if you look at any publishing guidelines, too, there's, you know, you have to write a book, you know, a lot of times the guidelines stress, you know, 50 to 80 page book. So, you know, a lot of times you're kind of shut out if you're writing something shorter,
mm-hmm.
or if you, for some reason, kind of go over that length. So, you know, the industry and the publishing industry really shapes the argument, too.
With Dickensian being paid by word.
Yes.
Yes.
So, so that has some effect. You know, you mentioned it being deleterious. You know, it may well be that that's what we're looking at. I think that Hill, you know, really trusted both his readership with the work, even, you know, obviously pre-internet, you know, he's been writing since, you know, the late 60s, early 70s, and really felt that tradition, as Elliot really defined it, is key for both looking forward and looking back. On the whole, I think that his work was refreshing in the sense that it was unapologetically challenging.
Well, there is something to be said for that. There is something to say, you know, I'm putting this before you. As difficult as it is, I'm putting this before you. It's not for everyone.
Right.
This dish is not for everyone. That's fine.
Right.
There are hot dogs and hamburgers down there, and then you have your bizarre cuisine of the month here.
Right.
If you're ready for that, right. Sure. You know, fried salamander?
Right.
Let's go for it.
Let's go for it.
And Hill is certainly fried salamander. Some people will appreciate him, but not the bulk.
Right.
And I think he was fine with that, which is great.
Well, I think that's great, too, because, you know, when you start, I think you get into a danger when you start ranking poets, right? This is the best of the last 20 years. This is the best of this school. This is the best of all time.
Right,
I think the best that you can really do is say, you know, this poet made a contribution, a significant contribution
impact
to the whole tradition.
To the conversation.
Right.
Yeah, definitely.
You know,
definitely.
That's where I think the merit lies. I think as well, when you look at that, I think a poet like Jeffrey Hill did make a significant contribution, and I think he did so like a poet like Anthony Hecht, who's kind of another
favorite.
You know, we're both, you know, Hecht more so, because I thought he was as elusive and literary, if I can use that, you know, without a pejorative, but he was also, in a way, you know, very kind of grounded and real, where
much more accessible.
Yeah, much more accessible, where Hill might go on flights of, you know, imagination and time travel almost, which kind of almost takes you out of, you know, to that, you know, what's really happening on the ground, at least on the surface of the poems. But still, you know, I think there's something to be said for those flights. or else you get kind of
a... There's a certain dementia incited by his language, by the high level of language. It's a duplicitous piece, though, because as complicated as it is, it doesn't always communicate despite that high language. He sometimes loses himself in the language and loses the point.
Mm.
Hecht, I think, was very much more to the point, very much more bringing the reader in, saying, come here, let me, as I'm gesturing, you know, come with me, we're going to have this conversation. It was never a point, the language never suffered, but there was also inclusion of the reader.
Right, right.
Yeah. And I think that's where he fails, actually.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, he certainly took risks, but I think at the end, too, if I think about it, it seems to me, to your point, that, you know, one of the things that, you know, really speaks then is that it gives you this kind of tradition that is multifolio.
Okay? Absolutely.
Because now we have different voices doing different things, and to your point, it's not going to suit everyone. But if you look at the tradition as an anthology rather than, you know, a personal book, this is my book and this
right,
is a tradition,
right.
But if you look at it as an anthology, then you can really kind of see where all of
it
these different voices
throughout the ages, exactly backward and forward.
Right.
You're absolutely right.
Right. So I think that's a more balanced way of looking at Jeffrey Hill's contribution rather than what has been at least eulogized by poets like Motion and even Seamus Heaney and Carol Duffy.
I don't know if we mentioned, did we mention Ovid in the Third Reich?
Only in passing.
Okay, that is certainly a poem that should be looked up and read. It is a quite amazingly, blisteringly good poem.
Yeah, and I think it's because it's one of those poems, if you'll agree, that isn't in the high language.
Exactly.
It comes down from the
exactly.
And really, it's very direct. It's very short, very pointed. It's almost devoid of descriptive. There's no flowers.
It's a plea.
Yeah,
it's a plea.
There's no flowers in it. It's really just straight on.
Yeah, certainly. Certainly. I think that's exactly the simplicity of it, the directness of the language. And like I said, to my mind, to my ear, it's a plea. It's something that's whispered quietly before storm.
Right.
And I think it's the only case where if one had to say, okay, is this a great poet? That would be the poem I would point to. I wish he had more of that sort.
Yeah. But it also benefits, too, from the fact that you have a lot of this high language. You have a lot of this difficulty.
Oh, yeah.
And now it just drops in. Yeah,
exactly.
It just drops in.
You know, to see, you know, to go through that thicket, that dense thicket, and come into the clearing of that poem.
Right. And then leave again.
And then leave again. You do have that sense of the mighty exhale, the great sigh of recognition. So I certainly think that is a point of
a
remarkability.
Again, I don't think it merits, you know, the greatest poet of all time, but you could start talking really about, you know, great poems, right?
Certainly.
You know, because I think that points to the idea again of just, you know, being fortunate enough as a poet to be able to say, well, I contributed a couple of pieces to the great tradition that we all share.
Correct. Correct.
So that would be, to my mind, you know, something that I would have been proud to put forward.
Certainly.
You know, when you're talking about, you know, the Mershon hymns or you know, King Log or whatnot, I mean, I don't think, you know, people, you know, can really kind of readily pull poems from there, but I think, you know, in the whole, I think it's a major contribution.
Certainly. I think there was some other small poems that had that vein, but it were not of that achievement. September Song from the same collection. There were one or two poems that fell into that vein that just worked so well. Of course, Ovid and the Third Reich being the best of them, but it gave you a certain look into that mind.
Right.
It was a moment of obvious quiet and not a rampaging thought process or, you know, dictionary-bound chant, essentially.
Yeah, something incantatory that, you know, by its incantation, you kind of get swept up.
Right.
And now, at some points, you kind of can get lost in that. You know?
Right, right.
Whitman can be as incantatory. He keeps it grounded in that democratic language.
Yeah.
Whereas here, we're kind of getting lost in the fog of time a lot.
Right, know, right.
Where we
fog of language.
Yeah, both, really.
Right,
and,
yeah.
And you kind of get disconnected because it's not as immediate for us. We
right.
have to go back.
It has to
pull the reference.
Exactly.
Yeah. Some people will, again, argue that that's, you know, the wrong way to tackle poetry, where, you know, when you're talking about it, you know, having to put the reader to some kind of work to do this kind of deciphering if it's not immediate.
Right.
But for me, you know, I, you know, and this is solely a personal, you know, opinion here, you know, I think the joy of discovery in poetry is really a wonderful thing. I mean, there's been some poems that, you know, you've read several times, you kind of stay with it, but, you know, it's only, you know, maybe a year later that some experience you do have or some new, you know, bit of knowledge really casts light on
it. Was,
and
yeah.
you get this moment of, oh, yes, it's now caught up to me or I've caught up to it.
Right,
and
right.
we're clicking now. And it's really kind of a numinous feeling.
And the greatest of those moments is to have a poem that works without knowing the references and that is only enriched by them.
I agree.
To have that pure enjoyment of a piece, completely, you know, ignorant, and not in a negative way, but just happen to be ignorant of that specific topic that they seem to be referencing.
Right.
But to read it and enjoy it, and then go, oh, wow, once you have this, it blossoms even further.
Yes.
And it has that strength.
I agree. So I think there's a lot. I think there's a lot in that, and that's probably a discussion we can continue. We're probably going to continue to have as we do more podcasts.
Well, and as we leave this portion of the podcast, and we're leaving Jeffrey Hill behind, and we're going to say hello to Kate Hudson.
Oh Lord, why Lord?
If you go back to today's the 10th of July in 2016,
is.
And if you look at Huffington Post, I'm sure you can still look it up at some point. Kate Hudson has penned a poem.
I wish he penned it.
Okay. A Shot in the Dark.
God bless.
This is scary.
Yes.
If I may.
Yes, please.
How I feel about Kate Hudson writing a poem is kind of like amateur brain surgeons.
Well, I like them.
They're great,
yeah,
but you don't want them working on you.
No, you do like to cuddle with them a little bit.
Of course. This is about as bad as we get.
Yeah, I know. I mean, this doesn't really even make it onto the web if it's
This is
not.
A high school poem. If anyone who would consider themselves to be a poet put this out there, there would be...
They would demand.
There would be a rank and file... Reaming and shaming. I think now we're looking at something that causes a little bit of stress if you're involved in poetry, is not even a dilettante, but someone who not only seeks to write a poem, but tries to affect social change through something that they're not able to execute.
Yeah, and to be fair, I mean, we both certainly understand the impulse behind the poem. We're going through some really tough times.
And it's a horrendous thing. And we're not commenting on the subject matter. The subject matter is grievous. The lack of peace, the raging of violence.
Right. I mean,
we're mocking Kate Hudson here.
Right.
And we're mocking the media that puts a poem like this out.
Yeah.
And says, hey, guys, this is what poetry is.
Yeah. I mean, to that end, too, the poem, if you haven't read it, is about, of course, you know, all of the shootings that we've had. Louisiana, Minnesota, the Dallas shootings as well. You know, all of us are really just, you know, brokenhearted that we just cannot seem to come together on this issue and get meaningful change.
So we agree with her, the sentiment.
Right.
It's the execution.
Well, and that's the problem, too, because we've talked before this podcast very often about, you know, how do you approach poems on sensitive subjects and try to approach them as a critic of art. And, you know, because you can only really come off as callous if someone is, you know, really writing this poem about a serious subject like, you know, the death of a loved one or a bout with cancer or some social problem. And, you know, so the first impulse is to not approach it critically at all. And that leaves you in a position.
A bind.
Yeah. Quite it leaves you in a position to just kind of
shrug.
Yeah. Or kind of
and
really.
Pass it on.
Yeah. And that kind of impacts the whole market.
I think what we need to do is we're going to address that, issue that we refer to as seal mothering next week. I think we're going to sit down and give that a good vetting, that process.
I think we should expand on that, but I think it applies here. So I think we have to talk about that a little
Certainly.
Bit, because otherwise it's just going to seem like some cheap shot at a celebrity, which is not really the intention
then,
here.
Today is seal mothering.
Yes, let's talk about it.
We had been in a poetry workshop with a teacher, and going around the class, one of the students had produced a poem and was going to read to the class, but introduced it with this line. This is about my mother's death. Now, only the callous and the cruel can come across and criticize something like that to someone's face.
Right. And, I was out in the hallway at the time getting a sandwich.
Oh, yes, even your sandwiches.
I know. Sandwiches.
But the thing is, and in it, where he utilized some Icelandic mythology to deal with the seal mother taking care of its pup and what have you. And hence the term seal mothering. You cannot criticize the work without being unusually cruel.
Yeah, and let me just also set this up a little bit too, because this was indeed about a seal mother.
Yes,
and
yeah, very
a
much
seal
was.
Pup. Now, we certainly don't remember, thank Christ, the actual poem, but if you can only imagine how terrible this poem really was, you know, it's, you know, short of him making seal noises, this thing
which
was,
would have only been an improvement. In
really,
fact, if the whole thing had been in seal, I would have been fine.
Yeah, I would have been too.
but it really puts you in a position where you cannot criticize the aesthetics without criticizing or mocking
the content.
The content.
Right. Which, and this was mockable.
And this is what we're saying the situation is with Kate Hudson. This
yeah.
is a seal-mothered poem.
Well, and it's also really, again, I understand the impulse here from Kate Hudson, because really it's a lament, right? But, you know, of course, it oversimplifies the problem. It really doesn't offer any solutions. But as a straight lament, I share the impulse. The problem, as Dan mentioned, is the execution. I think it's a little, to be
juvenile,
to be kind. Yeah, it's a little simple. But again, if you look at this, I don't think you're going to see even the Huffington Post or I think it was Entertainment Weekly that's profiling it. You're not going to see someone say that this is.
A horrific poem,
yeah,
but
right.
We all agree with you.
Yeah,
they're going to say, "Hey, look at this poem by Kate Hudson."
Yeah, it's wonderful. Yeah. So
she's an actress, you know.
Yeah,
they write poetry too.
Yeah, they
just not.
Yeah, no, just only the published poems.
That's so. Right. So the question of seal mothering comes in as a stopgap for anyone who's presenting a poem. And the poem not being up to critical snuff.
Well, I just remember in that workshop too that after the poem ended, nobody said anything about it. We were just staring at each other.
You and I kind of snickering and not to be cruel again. And even in this, I feel the need to qualify. We weren't being cruel. It was a silly poem.
It was silly.
And
I had to be cruel. You know what? We were being a little cruel because
it was silly.
Because it's silly.
It begged to be beaten up.
Well, this is also the same guy who has no problem in the class, being snarky at other points to
exactly.
other people's poems.
Right.
So now to come in behind that and start qualifying his poem as, I'd really prefer that nobody criticize it. My dead mom, who I'm going to
eulogize
as a
seal.
As a
seal mother.
So, because I mean, there's a whole host of other animals you could have picked.
It doesn't matter the animal. The problem
is, I feel like if it was a platypus unicorn kind of hybrid.
I'm not buying into the unicorn thing. Go away with that.
Well, the problem is, it's a hybrid. The platypus.
No unicorns whatsoever.
Egg laying horse. Oh, come on. That could have been something.
But the point is,
my heart is already pumped.
You see how it is? If I may,
you can't say, but I'm tearing up.
He is, and it's disgusting. But the problem is, when someone qualifies something that they're not good at with something that socially would be horrible to mock, it happens. We should. The thing is, you cannot. If you're coming at from an aesthetic, critical standpoint, it's fair game. As bad as that seems, it comes off bad, but it should not be excluded from that process. Simple.
Well, I mean, if you're saying that it's a poem, then I think you're also saying in some ways that it's an art form. So it does kind of.
Well, you would think that would be the definition.
You would think it would be, but you know, then that means it hews to certain aesthetic principles, aesthetic questions, as opposed to you know, a piece of journalism or even a diary entry, you know,
right.
Which
it's not just a raw piece of emotion observation,
right? Because you can take what would better fit in a diary and simply break it up into lines and stanzas.
Mm-hmm.
But I wonder if you can reasonably call that a poem at that point. And if you do, then it now comes into the, purview of a critical aesthetic assessment, or at least a portion of it has to be, you know.
Right. And therefore it's within the range finder. You are allowed to take shots of it. It's fair game.
If it deserves it, yeah.
It's
you know,
fair game.
At least, you know, from an aesthetic standpoint. Now, of course, you could say, well, you know, where's your aesthetic? Is it, you know, are you talking from a Western tradition of, you know, iambic pentameter, four line, you know, broken into quatrains, you know, sonnets, or are we talking about some kind of, you know, break from the Western tradition, or it's my own tradition, where's that aesthetic? But regardless, there is an aesthetic that I think you want to talk about.
Well, the perfect.
Yeah, the perfect is the worst part.
Well, I had twice.
Yeah, man. It's disgusting.
Listen, but the perfect example is Dylan Thomas intoning rage against the dying of the light. There was an aesthetic line there. There's an aesthetic shell to this moment of asking his father to keep going.
Yeah, certainly by itself, I mean, it's really an almost unembroidered line, but when you put it into the villanelle
exactly.
that he wrote.
Yes. Despite the fact that being a plea to his father, as you know, the seal mother was to this young gentleman's mother, he committed the act of transcending it into art, that plea into art. It wasn't something that just became silly in and of itself.
Yeah, it wasn't simply an appeal. It was an appeal and through art.
Correct.
So
and that transcendence is the part. That's what you're looking for in art. You're looking for transcendence.
Yeah, and especially in poetry, you know.
Exactly.
Now, this isn't to suggest that you cannot write a prose poem or it can't be unmeted or anything like that, because, you know, that would imply, because it's in a villanelle, you know. But when
it benefited from that.
It certainly does. And I think as a craft, you know, I think it's really kind of on the upswing where people are starting to explore more, you know, more rhyming, more meter now than ever before in the last, you know, 30, 40 years. But because I think that the argument that, you know, the kind of the Western tradition is kind of petered out, I think people are finding new entrances to it now. And, you know, I think...
Right, the chaos is coming back to form.
I think so. I think, you know, if anything, I think, you know, the great poets probably would show a range in their work. you know, someone who could do something really great in a lot of different forms, in things that don't have form, that would be a kind of a nice, you know, oeuvre to see.
Correct, yeah. You know? That shows the person who knows all the rules and can abide by all of them, and then to transfer over and say, I am fully aware of the rules, and this is how you break them artfully.
Right, right. You know,
in the correct way.
Yeah, you know, like Picasso, who, you know, had fantastic natural drawings, but then it broke that.
Or my constant is Dolly, where his realistic work is amazing, quite amazing. And then his surrealistic work, it's a different language that's derived from that formal work.
Right.
And since he knows how to do the formal work, his derivational language, his dialect, is as strong.
Right. I agree. So, I mean, I think there's a lot there to speak about, but when we're talking about a poem like Kate Hudson's, I think what we're looking at is something here that really is about 4, 5, 6, 12 revisions away from something that you would say aesthetically is effective.
Yeah. You know, like we said, just to cap it off, because again, this calls for that qualification. We appreciate the sentiments.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I'm sure it's coming from a good place. The execution is what's failing.
Yeah, so, you know, I mean, God bless us all if it inspires, you know, some movement on the needle on that discussion, then, you know, I think we'd be the first to say that, you know what, it was effective. And
right.
It's
it may not be a great poem,
yeah,
but
it was effective and a treasure for it.
Exactly. Exactly.
But
over and all, not so good.
Yeah.
Sorry, Kate.
I don't think anyone else would publish this. It would get any kind of reaction at all.
No. So. Outside of laughter, and that's about you.
Right. It was bats.
Okay, so I think that's where we are for this week.
Yeah. Thank you again for being with us at Alamos. We'd like to thank our sponsor for tonight's show, Purvis's Wet Cream. Beat like a dream. Wet Cream! Now we're off to the Poetry Festival at Governor's Island in New York City, and we'll bring back florid reports of all of its meretricious love, candy, and pugilism. We'll also read some favorite poems and continue to ask the big questions about the little issues. Please feel free to write us at alymus@yahoo.com, alymus@yahoo.com, and if it's frisky enough, we'll read your letter on the air. Until next time,
bye.
Bye.